Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, the podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkor, and more importantly, today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Ina Ilkama, who is assistant professor at the University of Southeastern Norway. We'll be talking about a brand new open access publication called The Play of the Feminine, Navratri in Kanchipuram. Ina, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Raj. I'm very excited to be here.
Yes, it's lovely having you, and it's especially nice to see you again. I mean, we've collaborated some time ago, I think, on the Nine Nights volume some years ago. So clearly you're very much still interested in the festival. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your interest in the festival and maybe the backstory for the book?
Yeah, sure. So the book is basically my PhD project. I wrote a monograph, which I now have published in book form. I was interested in goddesses and goddess traditions, and I already had a network in Tamil Nadu since I did my MA on the village goddess Mariamman and her mythology. Then I visited a lot of Mariamman temples and other goddess temples in Tamil Nadu, and many of these goddess temples celebrated Navaratri grandly. I was there in the autumn. A great spectacle, lots of people coming. Many exciting and diverse rituals, such as these enactments of the goddess's fight with a demon, wonderful elaborate themed alankaras, which are decorations of the goddess, women and girls being worshipped as the goddess, and so on. So I was intrigued by these, by what was going on, really. One of these temples is one of the temples that I write about in my book, one of these Mariamman temples. And here women's rituals were very prominent. Women participated in bhakti rituals, processions, pujas, so on. And I also became familiar with this Goli tradition, a South Indian practice, which I guess I will elaborate on later. And I was intrigued by how the festival had this domestic side to it. So this kolu is something you do at home, as well as these temple rituals going on for 9 or 10 days with huge celebrations. So that's how my interest was sparked. I wanted to know really what was going on and to see if there was any connection between what happened in homes and what happened in the temples. And studying Navaratri in Kanchipuram also allowed me to do a project where I could combine fieldwork with looking at Sanskrit texts as a Sanskrit scholar. So I also look at mythological texts as well as a ritual text. The book is not really that textually oriented. I deal a lot with oral traditions as well. So the temple I just talked about, which is called the Padavetaman temple, it's not scripturally sanctioned, and neither is this scholarly tradition. So the Sanskrit texts then mainly pertain to the Kamakshi temple, which is the second temple that I'm talking about in my book.
Could you say a little bit? We'll dive into the content, but say a little bit about the methodology, about the interplay of, you know, looking, being both, you know, as you probably well know, I'm a textual scholar. I quite enjoy lived religion, and I think I enjoy people so much. I use my ethnographic skills as a podcast host. But could you tell us about the interplay between religion on the ground and textual traditions? Is it common? Is it uncommon to sort of marry the two and look at both? And what's that like for you in terms of being both a textualist and an ethnographer?
Well, I think until quite recent times, it has been quite uncommon. You know, anthropology is one discipline, and religious studies, which mainly has been focused on texts, is another. But the way I see it, I mean, these fields are interconnected, and it makes sense to look at both whenever that is possible. So, yeah, even though I ended up maybe with a book which is a bit more anthropological than textual, I think the texts almost also illuminate what's going on the ground, and it's important to investigate both.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I wanted to hear your perspective on it, but certainly it is relatively rare in this slow burning time of scholarly production. It's fairly recent that we have an integration of both, but there have been a number of recent publications, I think, where we see more of an interplay between textual studies and what's happening on the ground. And how could they not be mutually illuminating, as you say? And I think just because, you know, people have different temperaments. And if you're used to studying texts, I mean, studying people might be alien to you. If you're used to studying people, you know, having your head stuck in Sanskrit grammar might be a little bit out of your comfort zone. But having both is great. And in my case, I surprisingly found that what I saw on the ground in terms of the ritual and the timing of the Navaratri ritual actually helped me to understand why the Devi Mahatmya was located where it was. It helped me to understand the Sanskritic canonization of the Devi Mahatmya and where it was located. And I have sort of a theory that has to do with the ritual timing of the actual festival on the ground. And it's really is a fascinating interplay, but I completely understand why certain scholars are geared towards one enterprise or the other. Now, tell us a bit about the distinction between these two temples, the Kamakshi temple and this other temple, and tell us a little bit about, you know, how are they demarcated? What's different about them overarchingly?
So the Kamakshi temple is an old temple, a temple which is very well known in the area in Tamil Nadu. It houses Kanchipuram's primary goddess or prime deity, Kamakshi. It's a Brahmin temple. It's a temple that belongs to the Sri Vidya tradition, which means it's a Vedika tantric temple where the goddess is worshipped in the form of yantra, the Sri Vidya yantra. So Kamakshi has Brahmin priests. Her temple and her traditions are scripturally sanctioned. I spoke that I have been looking at some of the texts. For instance, one text called the Lalitupakhyana, which narrates about Kamakshi and her manifestations in Kanchipuram, how she is higher than Vishnu, higher than Shiva, who is also manifest there. But the other temple is a temple of a village goddess, or a so-called village goddess, called Padavetaman, who is then a form of Mariaman. This is a small local temple, which is of newer origin. It's from the 70s, but it's very, very popular. It draws a huge crowd for its celebrations. And here, the goddess is, she's not part of the Sanskritic ritual tradition or Sanskritic mythological tradition, but she, of course, has a very rich oral mythological tradition surrounding her. So what was interesting was investigating what could be called as the sort of same rituals in these two temples, which were enacted very differently. For instance, the goddess's killing of the demon.
So can you say a bit more about the oral aspect of this, as you say, sort of non-Brahmanic temple? Are there particular myths that are well known among attendees? Or tell us more about, because I think you're uniquely poised because you have access to this tradition that doesn't exist in text. And so often we have the bias that or the conception that, you know, it starts with the text and then there's a tradition. But so often in the Indic world, the text actually is a condensation of an extant tradition, and you have access to a tradition that no one else has access to unless they go there and they study it. So tell us a bit about this oral culture, if you will.
Yeah, she's actually a very interesting and goddess. So her name, Padavataman, relates to the place where she originated, which is a place called Padavidu, which is in northern Tamil Nadu. And she has this, almost all manifestations of Mariamman relate to this one myth in which she is beheaded. So this is a goddess who is worshipped in her temple as a form, as a head in the sanctum. So she's represented there either only as a head or as an erect statue with a head in front of it. And this relates to her origin myth, which is very well known, where she gets decapitated by her son, Parashurama. This is also known from Sanskrit sources, but here the woman who is decapitated is known as Renuka. But Renuka then, from the texts, become Mariamman on the ground. There are also some Renuka temples, but very often she is called Mariamman. And she's beheaded because she transgresses this sexual norm. She sees a Gandharva or something who is making love in the water, and then she is beheaded. She loses her chastity. So she was originally a woman, an ordinary woman, married to a sage Jamadagni, and then all these things happened. She got beheaded. And what's interesting is that in these local versions of the myth, this is not something which is in the Sanskrit sources, but in the local renderings, Renuka or Mariamman's head is then switched with a non-Brahmin woman's head, so that her head gets attached to a non-Brahmin body. And this is why she then merges into the ground with her non-Brahmin body. So the Brahmin head is only visible, and she's worshipped in the form of a head. And then she becomes a goddess who particularly helps her devotees. I mean, she can help with anything, but in scholarly literature, she has this connection to pox diseases, and particularly chickenpox. So people very frequently go to her temples in the summer season to get rid of the chicken pox.
Yeah, it's a fascinating myth. It's not just a myth resulting from Brahmanization, but it's also a myth depicting Brahmanization, as it were. And, you know, I recently collaborated with one of our colleagues, Noor, who studies a regional Kerala a goddess tradition, Bhadrakali Mahatmya. And it's really fascinating to sort of tease out the extent to which we see local tradition borrowing from Pan-Indic tradition or vice versa. And so do we even have a sense as to whether the Renuka myth comes first or whether the Renuka myth is actually a Brahmanization of a local Mariamma myth? It's I imagine that would be all conjecture at this point, but it's could you say a word about the extent to which one tradition borrows from the other?
I think that's not possible really to figure out what comes first. I mean, these things might have influenced each other. But what's interesting is, I mean, this myth is very much alive in the surroundings of the temple. I mean, people are aware of the story. They know it. They narrate it. It's reflected there in her image in the sanctum. So this is her creation story. But then the myth of Mahisha, Mahishasura and Durga is attached to her. So during Navaratri, she then kills the demon Mahisha and takes the form of Durga. So of course, these myths all relate to each other. But in the case of Kamakshi, she kills another demon. She has nothing to do with Mahishasura. And here we see that this demon myth is very fundamental. After Kamakshi has killed the demon that she kills, which is called Bandhasura or Bandhakasura, what she does is, she settles in Kanchipuram and she asks the god to create the temple for her, the Kamakshi temple. And then the ritual handbook is created, which they use in the temple. It's so interesting to see how these myths interplay with each other and what role they have in the temples.
Utterly fascinating. Yeah, clearly there's a... Clearly, you know, as I've said this a number of times, you know, the best books are beginnings, right? The best books aren't endings. And clearly there are a number of threads here that could well be developed further. Now, the book, for those listening, is divided into two parts. The first part is, Navaratri and Myth and Temples. I think we've touched on some of the themes thereof in these two temples. The second part is Navaratri at Home. And the first substantive chapter of part two is something you mentioned in passing, the Kolu. Tell us a bit about this, because there may be, certainly there many of our listeners will be familiar with, as India is home to a vibrant goddess tradition, even the autumnal goddess festival. But this is a relatively unique phenomenon that's so vibrant. And yet outside of this particular context, I think few know what Kolu is. So tell us about this.
And it's also a very interesting ritual. I myself am very fond of this part of the book in particular, which deals with Kolu. It's interesting and fascinating. So the Kolu tradition is a South Indian tradition. It's spelled as Kolu, but pronounced as Golu. And basically, it's a display of dolls, mainly clay dolls. And since they are made of clay, they are said to have some divinity attached to them. So these clay dolls are then displayed on steps, on nine steps, ideally, correlating to the nine nights of Navaratri. And they may represent, mainly deities, but almost anything. So you have themes from stories, from mythological stories, which are depicted through these dolls. You have rituals, which are depicted, like weddings, processions, cricket matches, and you can also add to these displays with anything from paper to cardboard, cotton, to personalize them. So for instance, you could find a Himalaya scene with gods popping up from cotton snow, just to give an example. So all these dolls are then displayed hierarchically on the steps, with deities on the top and human beings, saints, and so on the bottom. You can even have children's toys on the floor. And the goddess is then usually installed among these dolls in the form of a pot. She's invoked in this pot. And women do this ritual. So women arrange the kolu and they invoke the goddess in the pot. And women also buy the dolls from the doll makers and decide on any themes and so on. And then you invite people home during Navaratri to watch this kolu, to sing for it, to chant for it, to recite Sanskrit shlokas for it, to eat, receive gifts. And some families are very, very, very elaborate on this practice. So they have huge doll displays, which can make up the entire living room, maybe even hallways. But other people have just started very recently, which is another interesting aspect of this, because previously Kolu was particularly a Brahmin practice or a high caste practice. And something I show and discuss is how non-Brahmin families from a variety of caste backgrounds now start practicing Kolu, and then how Kolu connects to sort of conspicuous consumption and how middle class Hindus may use this ritual to display their wealth, because it's an unspoken rule that you have to buy at least one new doll each year. Most people buy more. So eventually you will end up with a huge collection. It requires money. You also need money to provide gifts to the visitors, because there are certain things you then have to present the women who are coming as visitors. And the homes, you know, people come home to you to see this. So the homes are opened up. The homes are on display and in a sense even become public. Some would compare their home to a temple once they had this Golu there with the goddess installed. But I also show how the ritual itself changes during this process. So for instance, I met a couple of families who would offer meat and alcohol to their Golu. And in one home, which I describe, the female hosts regularly becomes possessed by the goddess on the Golu. So she uses Navaratri and Golu then as an occasion to speak prophecy to her visitors. So these are among some of the interesting aspects of these traditions. Also social commentary, if I can just say a couple of words about that, because you can use the Golu to make displays of any kind. And very often, you see this in the media as well, you can make themes which reflect current events, like organ donation, solar power, traffic problems in Chennai. And very often, these themes may reflect recent events. So that when the Shabrimala case happened, for instance, where women went to the Shabrimala temple in Kerala, where they previously were not allowed to enter, then people started making Shabrimala displays in their Golu. Or when the chief minister Jaya Lalita died, she died a few years back, then Jaya Lalita dolls, the sale of these dolls increased, for instance. So there are so many interesting things or angles to aspects of this Golu practice, which I look into.
Fascinating. Is this a women's practice? Is this a women's space?
Yes, definitely. So not necessarily, but very often, women are the ones who put up the Golus, do the rituals, and women also go from home to home and visit each other. I think that I myself visited 50, 60 Golus during my two periods of fieldwork. And I never visited a place where there were males present unless they lived in the household themselves. So unless they were the husbands of the women who had the Golu. So definitely. But with a few exceptions, the priests of the Kamakshi temple, for instance, they were very eager to have a say in where the dolls were going, or the dolls' arrangements. Maybe it has to do with them being experts on decorating the goddess's image in the temples. Maybe that's something I discuss. And I also met this very interesting or fascinating guy, a man who was a Vishnu devotee, who made or fashioned his own Golu dolls out of waste material. So he was interested also in arts and crafts, which probably inspired his take on the Golu. This was a Golu, a one-of-a-kind Golu. Usually people buy the dolls. They don't necessarily make them themselves. But his Golu also demonstrated maybe some limitations to this practice, since he was very He did it as a sort of social commentary, environmental commentary, using waste material. But by the Vaishnava community, it was not met with much enthusiasm to make gods, and particularly to make Vishnu, out of waste.
What surprised you, or what struck you about this research?
Well, maybe how flexible these rituals are, despite of lots of unwritten rules to how to do the Kali practice, and written rules on how to do temple practice. It's a lot of space to do variations in ritual. Not one Kali was similar to another. Actually, the only thing which was present everywhere, and now I speak of the Kali tradition, was this tambulam, to give a plate of gifts to the visitor. The gifts may vary, but that was the one thing which was the same in every home. Also in temples, when I did my fieldwork back in 2014, 2015, they had the tradition in the Kamakshi temple to worship altogether 8 girls as the goddess. So they worship girls and invoke Kamakshi on them. But I've learned that now they have 108 girl puja in the Kamakshi temple. So things change, things develop. And that's interesting. And I also got an eye-opener on how to conceive of texts. So the texts were my starting point, and I came to Kanchipuram with a quite naive idea that the priests, for instance, would know the texts well, or perform what was in the text. But the priests I spoke to, they didn't have the Sanskrit texts, so they had them memorized. They just had them in a different manner, so to say. And it became clear to me that a text for the priests was something else than a text for me, or what I thought of as a text. So this research also broadened my understanding of texts to include texts as embodied, or texts as enacted, or performative, or more fluid notions of texts. So
fascinating. Yeah, it's really refreshing to hear your mark about the quote-unquote texts. I mean, part of my training, I mean, as you well know, I have academic training, and part of my training was actually part of an extant oral lineage of teachings, primarily on texts such as the Bhagavad Gita and Yoga Sutras. And so every once in a while, I have an online school where, you know, I teach basically anybody who's interested, but every once in a while, there might be a very keen student who's very, very much interested in learning the Yoga Sutras, and I may take them on and share one-on-one exposition. And so often I get the comment, wow, I haven't seen this before, or where is this from, or which commentary is this from? And it's so challenging to communicate to a Western student in particular that there's so much knowledge that's preserved orally. It's not written down. It's not in a text. It was learned sort of, you know, person to person, parampara, you know, from one to the other. And this is, I think this is a really, I think it's an intriguing and perhaps even vexing idea that there might be canonized material, but canonized in a very different fashion, where it's orally preserved and used day in and day out in a very different way. And also texts such as, for example, the Yoga Sutras. I mean, clearly they were composed for exegesis. Sutric material isn't remotely standalone. So as evidence from the actual sutras, it's meant to be used as a prop or as a starting point for commentary within tradition. So I find it fascinating that you saw the same thing within the ritual context of the temples. What would you say you hope folks most take away from the book? What are some key takeaways or ideas, or, you know, what is the work that you think the book is doing?
Well, I hope that the readers will learn something about women's rituals, but also, local vernacular traditions. I mean, I feel that I do a lot in the book. So there's...
You do.
There's something for everyone in here. And the festival is, of course, a tremendously rich and very diverse festival, which I try to analyze as a celebration of the goddess's powers in association with women, and how women can tap into these powers. I think it will be relevant for scholars or students of festival cultures, South Asian festival cultures, both vernacular and temple rituals, women's studies, mythology,
ritual studies, you name it. So of course, you know, one of my purposefully naive questions was going to be, so the play of the feminine, what does that mean? But I think at this point we realize it's a bit of a pun, isn't it? It's about the feminine divine and also the sphere of the earthly feminine. Maybe two more questions before we close for today. One is your sense that women have always been so robustly empowered in this space? Or is your sense that there's something about our changing times that's contributing to women's roles and women's empowerment in these spaces?
Well, that's a bit difficult to answer since the study is, of course, contemporary. But I think that the home might have provided this space for women for a long time, but maybe it hasn't been that visible until now. I mean, women's rituals are not scripturally sanctioned. They're not part of the Sanskrit tradition. They have been transmitted orally. But this is about to change. You find these magazines describing rituals to do during Navaratri, for instance, so that these non-Brahmin families, who, for instance, are starting up with Golu, they can consult these magazines now in writing to get to know what to do, which for the Brahmins was knowledge which was traditioned, transmitted from family member to family member, as part of their tradition. So that is one change. And also, you know, homes are opened up more now maybe than they were before. Also, maybe social media plays in here, that people are able to display these rituals that they do in their homes through social media. So things are definitely changing.
Yeah. Well, thank you for indulging the conjecture. Of course, I often ask questions that are beyond anyone's radar, but they're sort of fun. And I've said before that generalizations are not occupational hazards. They're actually assets on podcasts. But this idea, this resonates, this idea that it's not such that women are now, only now, empowered in the home sphere, in the domestic sphere. I mean, just in terms of my own perspectives from reading and also witnessing Hindu homes, particularly diasporic Hindu homes, it's such that the empowerment of women on the home front is more visible, mm-hmm. and we have more access to it. It's more, and also, Golu or not, whether it's a religious phenomenon or just a sort of a other facets of the home life, we have so much access to people's home lives thanks to Facebook or social media, where people will share what they're up to in their home sphere in a way, curated, albeit, but they'll share. We have access via social media. So I think that really sounds apt. That's a huge game changer in terms of publicizing what has been going on perhaps behind in a more cloistered space hitherto. Perhaps the last question I'd like to ask is, could you say a little bit about what it was like coming into these spaces as a researcher, potentially an outsider? You know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but also potentially as an honored guest, you know, as a researcher, as a Westerner, as a, what was the reception like? Were there concerns that, you know, of being scrutinized and being studied, or you know, what was it like for you in terms of your role as a researcher in these spaces?
Well, all people were very friendly. When I went Golu jumping, which is the word for going from home to home watching Golus, I usually had a female research assistant with me who was Tamil and who could translate for me. I speak only a little bit Tamil myself. We usually showed up unannounced, but this is not uncommon during Navaratri and during Golu. I mean, people go Golu hopping and you never know who may show up. So people gladly invited us in and gladly spoke about how they spoke about their Golu traditions, how they celebrated Navaratri. Everybody was very open. The things, I mean, I had great help bringing with me my research assistant, who could also explain to me the things that I mean, all the stories in the Golu, for instance, which I didn't necessarily recognize. What was depicted there, she could explain everything to me. The Tamils are very friendly, and I felt welcome. And what was interesting was, I think I mentioned that it's common to sing in front of these goddesses and recite for the goddess. So I often was invited to sing. So I've sung a lot of Norwegian folk songs and even the Norwegian national anthem in very many homes in Kanchipuram for these field works.
That's beautiful. Can you imagine you singing Norwegian? And there's just something so incredibly syncretic about Hindu traditions. It's sure, let's add some Norwegian to the mix. Why not?
It's lovely.
A final thought. Is there, are you continuing this work in some way? What's next for you? What are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on writing a book in Norwegian about Hindu goddesses and goddess traditions. So I will most likely not be invited back to the podcast to promote that. But it's not much written on Hinduism in Norwegian. We have a few introductory books. So I will use some of my experiences and encounters with the goddesses in that book. And we have a quite a huge Tamil diaspora here in Norway, actually. Just this past summer, it opened, Norway's biggest Hindu temple opened, which is a Tamil temple, which is the first temple to be constructed as a Hindu temple. A proper Hindu temple. So Tamil architects designed the inside and Norwegian architects designed the outside. So I'm very eager to do some research there on the Tamil diaspora here and maybe also investigate how they celebrate Navaratri. So we'll see. And I work in the teacher education currently, teaching Hinduism and also Buddhism and Sikhism to future RE teachers or religious education teachers. So I have a project where I'm interested in how Hinduism is being taught in the Norwegian school system. So yeah, a few things coming up.
Well, that all sounds incredibly fascinating, and I can't help but muse that there's one temple that I frequent from time to time. It happens to be a Tamil temple. It's not in Toronto proper. It's about 45 minutes away, north of Toronto. And it's ancient. It's ancient by North American standards. It was built by Tamil immigrants, but this would have been the early 1980s. So I'm musing to myself that this process is being, that a similar process is happening right now where you are in Norway that happened in Toronto quite some time ago, and so it really is fascinating to study diaspora traditions. Thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Thanks for inviting me.
For those listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Ina Ilkama on the play of the feminine Navaratri in Kanchipuram. It's open access, so click the link in the podcast notes, and you'll be able to download the entire book and have a read. Until next time, keep well listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating the power of the feminine. Take care.